Thanks, Mark. And that conversation that we had, I don't know how many years ago it was, after the STEP class, was really, for me, very much a watershed moment. So I'm just really, really grateful for Mark's counsel that day and also for EMS's partnership and working with either bivocational or full-time pastors and really workable solutions to enter into a degree program. I want to begin this morning by inviting you to frame this conversation about theodicy. What do you see is a question when you look at that image. Theodicy and a Christian witness has been a very, very difficult conversation, I think, since the creation of the world. And we see theodicy just throughout the whole narrative of Scripture. And so it's been facing humanity, humankind, ever since. And it causes us a lot of wrestling. So this image really resonates with me in an attempt to try to frame this discussion. And so I asked the question of what is it that you see? And just to take a moment and just to kind of internalize that question, you have this massive iceberg, you have this small ship, and there you have the image. And what is it that you, is there anything else that you may see in that image? My perspective of theodicy is very much linked or likened to this image here. And I've come away with three conclusions that was very helpful for me. And so my sharing today, I'll be sharing some experiences with the congregation as we've journeyed. But this is probably more a reflection on my own formation, which then I'm trusting will help to form and lead the congregation as well. But three things. Number one is the vulnerability of this small ship alongside a very seemingly large iceberg. And an unpredictable iceberg, invisible and unknown to those on the ship. And perhaps the word Titanic would help center that imagery. But then you also have the vastness of the sea, which carries both the ship and the iceberg. And my impression has been, as I have immersed myself in this study, is how often we focus on the ship or the iceberg, and we fail to even consider the depth, the power, or the unknowns of the sea, which carries both the ship and the iceberg. So the reality for me as I got into this study is to again get back to an appropriate perspective to the ocean. And I have been very humbled to consider how many persons shipwrecked their faith on this subject. The more reading I did, and as I began to engage a class in our congregation, there was a bit of fear and trembling within me of persons, great men and women of faith who have abandoned faith, renounced faith, became either atheist or agnostic as a result of the inability to reconcile the iceberg or the theodicy question. And so it's a very, for me, was a very sobering study. And so that's my title, Pastoring with a Christocentric Theodicy in a Traumatized World. And it was very intentional. This title is not me. It's very academic. I usually don't use so many words in a title. But two words that I really wanted to draw out in selecting this title is Christocentric and also traumatized. And to be able to reconcile both of those realities. So why did I focus on this? Well, I've discovered that there's many ways to pastor, and I've observed many pastors pastoring in ways that made me uncomfortable. But from my own experience is the everyday stuff of being in the trenches of everyday ministry, just everyday life, of how much both the need for a Christocentric approach and also the reality of trauma that is our world is immersed in. And I became very quickly aware that there are many questions in life that as a pastor I am unable to answer. And what do I do with that? And how do I live with that tension? or situations that are very hard to reconcile, even in a faith perspective. So several weeks ago, I was with just to give you an example, several weeks ago I was with a family, a beautiful couple who I married and provided to premarital, and they buried their day-old baby. And that was hard for me, hard for them. But to sit with this beautiful couple and wrestle with these questions of where's God and why did God allow this to happen? Yesterday, I sat with a husband whose marriage is imploding and is in deep distress, and trauma is just a part of their story. And I was again reminded of how do I reconcile his reality with what's going on in my own understanding of faith and the mystery of God. Tomorrow, I have a funeral service for a woman who suffered with Alzheimer's in her 80s, 89 years old. Alzheimer's for the last 8 years. And how do you reconcile Alzheimer's and the family that lost their mother 8 years ago, technically, and that tension and that reality? So as I looked at the Gospels and the reality that most of Jesus' ministry, particularly his healing ministry, came in the form of interruptions. It's not scripted. It just happened. As Jesus went on his way, persons in the midst of their trauma, in the midst of their brokenness, were reaching out, and Jesus met them, he wept with them, he loved them, and he oftentimes healed them and restored them. But then there's that tension or that reality that Jesus also went on to the next village. And not everybody was healed. Not all the evil was purged from that community. And so there's a tension that I found in naming this reality that Jesus did not fix or heal everyone as he went. And so the question that begged for me is, as Jesus went, where was God? I came on this image that this is theology's toughest question, is the question of theodicy. And I, in a posture of transparency, I would be the first to say that when I signed up for this particular theme, I had no idea what I was getting myself in for. And I began to discover very quickly that there's been a lot of ink spilled on this subject and a lot of bizarre theological spins and positions on the subject. And the impact of the European Enlightenment of the 18th century and its impact on what now has formed a lot of theology along this subject, where, as I mentioned earlier, of great theologians here even in the 21st century who have become agnostic or atheist as a result of this question. And that shook me to realize how sobering this conversation is. Dr. Mark Wanger, who has been supervising me just a couple weeks ago as we were talking about coming down the stretch here, I shared with him my struggle with this subject. And then he reflected back to me, he says, well, I was kind of surprised you picked such a subject. And I thought to myself, well, sure, it would have been nice to know that about half a year ago. But Mark, Dr. Wanger, in his wisdom, he allowed the ship to leave port and to sail into the deep sea, and I found myself immersed in this ocean of discovery. And for that, I thank him for allowing me to...
That's a backhanded
to kind of swim in this ocean. The past 10 years or so, I've served as a volunteer chaplain to our local police department, which has been just a real blessing for me, especially in an Anabaptist understanding and the whole idea of peace in the midst of various understandings has really been a blessing. But one of the primary roles of that responsibility, beyond just supporting the officers, is also to assist in trauma situations, and most often it comes in the form of death notifications. And so this whole idea of theology's toughest question, I don't know of anything more gut-wrenching for myself than to stand on somebody's front porch ringing their doorbell in the wee hours of the morning, or going to their place of employment and rousting them from their normal day to inform them that tragedy has come into their family, and to know that myself and the officer are carrying that day news that will forever change their life, news that may forever change their understanding of who God is. And then I'm asked to stand there with an officer of the law. I'm to stand there to represent God. And so this tension of how to do that, it's an awful and a dark place to stand. And an attempt to represent God, yet I submit we must and we do so. These two images, one on the left here is by Léon Bonnet from France in 1865 in the tale of Enlightenment. But it's entitled, a very simple title, it's entitled Job. And the rendering here on the right is the other spectrum of the God story of the book of Revelation, and an image there of the apocalypse. But these theodicy tensions throughout Scripture, Job becomes kind of the test case or the ongoing case study for this whole subject of theodicy. And most scholars universally agree that the Job narrative occurred very early into the biblical account, likely a contemporary of Abraham or certainly the early patriarchs. But one of the gifts that this narrative gives in all of its mystery for me personally is chapters 38 through 41. And that's where, depending on the version of Scripture that you use, after all the academics and the intellectuals and the pastors come and speak, God listens to all that, puts up with it, and then in chapters 38 through 41, God responds back to Job with between 69 and 75 questions. And I find myself having much comfort that the fact that all 75 of those questions remain unanswered by Job. And what's also really striking for me is that Job, in chapter 1 and chapter 2, when you see that story, when all hell breaks loose in that story, he takes on the posture of sitting in sackcloth and ashes. And when you get to chapter 42, Job again assumes that same posture, sitting in sackcloth and ashes, after God has spoken. And I find something really centering and very refreshing that is a model for us in the midst of this question. And we can see the activity of God in the midst of his hell, of his story, and all that was going on in the heavenlies that we don't understand. You can read the rest of the God story, even through the book of Revelation, and we see the activity of God, the presence of God, in the midst of all that. And for myself, that has been very, very helpful and a good framework for this discussion in my own understanding. I offer these two images to you and for your own reflection with a simple question of which image are you drawn to? Which image draws you? What do you see? What are the differences? And obviously one has a crucifix and the other is a evangelical postured cross, shiny and clean, and Christ off the cross. And does the image that we're drawn to, what might that say about our theodicy? What might that say about our understanding of God? What might that say about our understanding of suffering? And do both have their place, and does it matter? So, some questions that bubble for me that I've forced myself to wrestle with Does the MHI prefer to embrace, shape, or negate a healthy Christocentric theodicy? Do I, and the Christian witness, avoid the suffering of the cross in haste of the empty tomb and a resurrected Christ? If yes, why might this be? And might the church have courage to posture theodicy through a suffering and eschatological redemptive lens? Do we have that kind of courage? And what I've found is that this image is often resisted. As a matter of fact, again, Dr. Wanger, as we were talking about this just a week ago, and we had this conversation, and he said, you know, Brian, he said, I think it would serve most Mennonite congregations well to have a crucifix somewhere in their worship space. And I thought, you know, that is very true. That would help us indeed. But I recognize this need to begin with my own self-awareness and of recognizing how is it that I understand a suffering Savior, and how can that help form a healthy theodicy? These are some sources that I found very, very helpful for me in my study, and some of these you may be familiar with. I would just reference this one on the end here in the far left, Sean Gladding, The Story of God, The Story of Us. And this, again, comes out of a class that I took with Dr. Wanger and Ann Kaufman Weaver, Formation in God's Story. It was a two-semester class. But this, in all my years of study, I never had an assignment like this. We had the book assignment that we were supposed to purchase, The Story of God, The Story of Us. But this had a nuance to it. Not only were we supposed to read the book, but we were supposed to read it one chapter a week aloud to a book buddy. And this book is framed on Psalm 137. And that's the text where, by the rivers of Babylon we wept, and we hung up our harps. And it's a very much of a lament. It's a despairing chapter in the Psalms. And I found myself, as I was reading this book, unbeknownst to me, that there was a theodicy stirring going on within me that I didn't even know what was happening. Because as we were forced to read this aloud, I selected my wife as my reading partner. And as we're reading this book, there's times where I couldn't read because I couldn't see through the tears. And I'm asking myself, what is going on with me? And I began to realize the way the author beautifully postures the book is this old man is down by the river along Babylon in captivity. And the people have given up hope. And they've hung up their harps. And this old man, this old elder of the people, he begins to tell the story of God from the beginning. And he just simply retells the story. And what he's basically doing is re-immersing the God story in the midst of their trauma and their disillusionment. And it was just a great introduction to what was going on, helping me to discover what's going on in my ministry that perhaps I wasn't even aware of. These other books, Resilient Ministry, is just a great formation about surviving and thriving. This book here by John Swinton, Raging with Compassion, was just a fantastic read. And this book I'll talk about just briefly, used in a class that I'm teaching right now as well. But each of these have really served me well. And what I come away with as a reminder is, when you take of the 150 Psalms, 67 of them, scholars say, are laments. And so if almost half of the Psalms are formed in lament, we have a whole book in the Bible of the Old Testament that is called Lamentations by the weeping prophet. What might that say about our space and our activity for wrestling with this question of theodicy and suffering and the heart of God? Swinton makes this profound statement in his book that he says that to sing happy songs of praise, in other words, to brace the evangelical cross, this is nice and clean and shiny and everything else, to singing happy songs of praise in the face of evil and suffering is a very different reality than what the Bible reveals. And I found that to be very true. So this was a class that I offered in our congregation, along with two sermons that were part of this. But I've entitled the class as Jesus Went, Where Was God? And using Thomas Long's book, What Shall We Say? And it's over seven different weeks. It's on a Tuesday night for an hour and a half. And as you can see by the dates, I have two more classes to go. I limited it to 35 people, and I found this incredibly hard to prepare for. Harder than I think any sermon I've ever prepared is preparing these lesson plans, and I've come away with a new appreciation for the variables that can happen within an academic study. But this part of this study has forced me to press into some of the tensions and the unknowns that I was perhaps just never considered before. And what I discovered is that I ended up with about 35 in the class, give or take a few. A couple couldn't handle it. They said it's either too academic or this theologian Thomas Long just makes me uncomfortable. And as disappointing as that was for me, there's others who have just, they're just like pigs at a trough. I mean, that's maybe a poor analogy, but they're just eating it up. They're just hungry. They're really into it, and that's a blessing, a willingness to engage. And so what I'm finding is not only stretching me, but it's also stretching them to sit with some of these questions. On the last week, here's the emphasis of how do we walk this stuff out? How do we walk out our theodicy as a healing community? And so the last week, I'm bringing in a neighbor who's actually was in a conservative Mennonite understanding, and her husband committed suicide. And I had a lengthy conversation with her just the other day, and just, how do you reconcile this experience? And how has that impacted your understanding of who God is? And so the whole idea of how do we become a healing community in the midst of the realities that we find ourselves in. So this was my desired outcome of the class and also this larger project. I'll not take time to read this. This is kind of the context for the class. But this last emphasis for the class itself will focus on growing a Christ-centered perspective in the midst of such questions, and will consider how we best engage a suffering and traumatized world. Diane Langbert, who was one of the authors that I mentioned earlier, in her preface of the book, she tells this story that she was in Ghana, Africa, and she was at the Cape Coast Castle, and it was there that back in the 15th and the 16th century, even into the 17th century, where hundreds and hundreds of thousands of slaves were kept in a dungeon in that castle. And they're down in this deep, dark dungeon of silence. And the guide asked the question, do you know what's above us? And nobody knew. What was above them was a chapel. And he said historically that as the worshipers were up in their chapel, the slaves could hear the worshipers. But likewise, the worshipers could also hear the agony of the slaves and did nothing, and just closed their ears to the cry of God. And so to me, it becomes this question. Slavery can look in many different models today, but how we best engage a suffering and traumatized world. So Swinton, I borrow this from John Swinton, of the faith community's need to rediscover the place of four things is basically what he comes away with. And this is what our focus over 4 weeks of the 7 weeks in the class is lament, forgiveness, thoughtfulness, and hospitality. I spent a week as part of my class. Assisting the chaplains at Phil Haven. Phil Haven is a hospital near Hershey that's founded in a Mennonite context as the boys and men come back from World War II did not go into service and went into voluntary service. Were serving in mental hospitals, and they were just seeing the deplorable conditions of the patients there, and out of that birthed this Full Haven Hospital. And also then in 1963, JFK went and actually signed into the law basically rewriting or rehabilitating all of mental health care that's still in act to this day as a result of what happened at Full Haven. But anyhow, I spent a week there, basically 50 hours with the five different chaplains, and was in every nook and cranny of the facilities. And I asked the one chaplain after my first day there, who'd been there for about 6 or 7 years, and I asked her, I said, of all your experiences so far, and also being deeply immersed in the church, what is the biggest thing that you, biggest voice or biggest plea that you would have for the church? Her answer was very simple, that the church would give more space for lament. More space for lament. And not as a mark of faithlessness, but as an act of faithfulness. In situations where faith, hope and faith are challenged. Forgiveness. In my class that I'm teaching at church, we, the last about 10 years, had the opportunity to walk with an individual in our congregation who has come out of satanic ritual abuse and just a very, very hard, painful experience, and continues to be. And it's not a sprint. This is a marathon. We continue to run toward the finish line, but a lot of work has happened and continues to be. But in her class, she had shared this with me in confidence in our times of pastoral care together, so it was no surprise to me, but we were talking about forgiveness just last week. And she flat out told the class, she says, the greatest perpetrator in my life is a family member. She said, I cannot forgive him. She said, I can't. And so the class is sitting there. We know full well what Jesus says. Unless you forgive others, you will not be forgiven. What do you do with this? And so that becomes, again, forgiveness is what Swinton is saying, becoming the ultimate form of resistance to evil and the unmistakable mark of the kingdom, coming kingdom. And so how we now as a church can walk with this reality and helping and trusting and believing that God will get to a place in her life where she will be able to forgive. Thoughtfulness. Swinton says it's the third dimension of theodicy, which fosters renewal of our minds and becomes a gesture of redemption. The chaplain, one of the chaplains up at Full Haven told me this powerful story of working with an individual who had a major meltdown, and was the staff and the medical staff was just at their wits' end of knowing what to do with this individual. And so they put the individual in what's called a quiet room and had an opportunity to minister to a number of persons who were in the quiet room over my days there. But this is literally a padded room with basically a 3-inch mattress on the floor, and that's it. And she said they locked this person in the room and basically was just trying to keep everybody and themselves safe. And after they tried everything, the chaplain approached the medical staff and said, can I try? And they said, have at it. By this time, this individual who was so traumatized and so upset had defecated over themselves and over their mattress, and it was now all over the walls and it was just everywhere. And as she opened the door, the odor of the feces and had just come spilling out of the room. And she felt the Spirit prompt her and said, I want you to go sit in the middle of that dung. And so she did. And she said, for the next hour and a half, I sat there in the middle of that poop and sang with him, prayed with him, wept with him. And for those 90 minutes, God ministered through thoughtfulness. Hospitality. As a church is called to share what it has, because what it has is not its own. This whole idea of being hospitable. And Thomas Long says, this happens, it's solved by walking. And I think for all of these, but particularly in hospitality, it's this question or this tension of theodicy is solved by walking. This is not a new image for any of you that are familiar with Dr. Mary Thiessen-Nation's work. I had taken her class last fall on ministering in times of trauma. And one of the things that Swinton really pushed his heart on is the whole idea of redemption. how does redemption work in the midst of trauma? And he goes so far as to say that the church can become evil if indeed it disallows persons from being able to break out of those cycles, either silencing the voice of the sufferer, not giving space for forgiveness, not giving space for lament, not giving space for hospitality, or simply just silencing their voice, then the church or faith becomes evil in and of itself and becomes an evil just like the evil is that has been inflicted upon them, which is a very sobering challenge. So, of course, the objective is to be able to find a way out of that cycle, or for the church to be able to break in and to interrupt that cycle. Swinton says, and I quote, he says, "The task of the church is not to explain suffering and evil, but to offer modes of resistance." And those other items of lament, forgiveness, thoughtfulness, hospitality are modes of resistance that the church can offer. And sadly, the church historically many times has not been a mode of resistance or a place of healing, but rather has been placed forms of resistance of blocking the redemptive work of God and healing either through packaged answers or only silencing the voice of the sufferer. This is a sermon that I preached, just the capstone of my 6 points that I gave that morning, using an Old Testament text of a great man of God, and that being the person of Elijah from 1 Kings chapter 19, and I called it A Broom Tree and a Crisis of Faith. But basically was trying to, this was before my class began, before I began teaching, offering the class at church, but basically wanting to give space for persons to allow themselves to be able to see the activity of God in the midst of suffering, and that believers can have a crisis of faith. And simply just acknowledging that God gives space under a broom tree when Elijah, at the end of the day, after a spiritual high, he totally crashes and burns and sits under a broom tree asking to die. He wants to die. But to be able to see that God gives space, God invited lament there, God was present, God touches him twice under the broom tree, God provided rest and hope, and then God also invited him to come, to step, to rise and to go. And so that was an initial introduction to this project publicly. And I will say after this message, I've had probably more reaction from the congregation than I think any other message I ever preached or presented. And it just told me that this is touching a need in our conversation. Then I had another sermon 2 weeks ago the week of Holy Week, and I've entitled it Lenses, and looking at the New Testament story of John 11 and the story of Lazarus. And these were the 10 overviews of trying to get the congregation to understand the activity of Jesus in the story of Lazarus. In the midst of this trauma, where was the activity of Jesus in that story? And these were the 10 points, which are fairly obvious. But then what I did is I overlaid it with what Jesus didn't do and what became the activity of the faith community. And that is to get in the way, of suffering and trauma. And that's what the sisters did. They got in Jesus' way. To remove the stone. Jesus didn't go down and remove this. He invited the church to remove the stone. To remove the clothing of death. Jesus didn't do that. He brought Lazarus to life, but he invited the faith community to remove the clothing of death and then to free and receive the dead. And again, what a different eschatology to frame theodicy, or a starting place for theodicy. So the parable of the wheat and the tares, and this is where the class is going this coming week, from Thomas Long's book. And when I was 20 years old, I spent a year on a wheat harvest, cutting wheat from Texas up through Great Falls, Montana, over about a seven-month period. And I remember when we were cutting in Oklahoma, it was really a wet Oklahoma that year, and we were in the town of Medford, and we ended up renaming it Mudford because it was just a lot of stuck combines, it was not a fun time. But I remember getting into wheat fields that looked like this. And that, my friends, is not a good day. A lot of weeds coming up in that wheat. And it's not fun to work with. It's hard to cut. It chokes up your combine. It's pathetic yield and all the above. Well, in Matthew 13, Jesus, where Long goes with this is Jesus is introducing a number of different parables. And he introduces the four soils, and then he explains it. Then he introduces the wheat and the tares, this text here. Then he introduces the mustard seed, and he also introduces the yeast. But then Jesus circles back to the wheat and the tares again, and he begins to explain it. And so what about the weeds is what, where Long is going, and this is his concluding summary, which I give him full credit for, that basically asking the question, God, did you cause this, the weeds? Can we fix it? Can we gather the weeds, and will it always be this way? What is our eschatological lenses that we're framing ourselves through? And so what Long is inviting us to, and Swinton, is to reframe our question on this question of theodicy. And recognizing that evil draws persons away from God, or even the possibility of that there is a God, and then actively blocking the redemption of God. But again, a reframing of the centrality of the cross and God moving toward creation through the radical gestures of redemption. And rather than asking the same old traditional question of where is God and why did God allow this, why does God allow evil, to reframe it in that, what does God do in response to evil? What does evil do to us? What does the faith community do in response? And return to a more practical, Christological approach to the problem of evil. And it's really an approach that was modeled by the early church, both in its Christology, but also in its eschatology. It was very Christ-centered, but was always looking toward the eschatology that was promised that we see in the book of Revelation. So Long is here with the here and the not yet, that we live in the now and the not yet. Satan's been defeated, but not yet been destroyed, and we know that full well. And so Jesus is clearly saying in this parable that, God, did you cause this? Did you sow the weeds? And Jesus is clearly saying, no. An evil person did this. An evil sowed the weeds. And then the disciples are asking the question, you know, can we make it go away? Or in the parable. And he says, no. If you go out into the field and you pull out the wheat, you're going to pull out the wheat as well. And so can we fix it? So Long's assessment is the answer there is no. Will it always be this way? Will the eschatological lenses always be this way? And of course the answer is no. So the answer to three questions is what Long submits there is no. Not that we can't interrupt or get in the way, that's the part of the faith community, get in the way of helping to sort out the weeds and the wheat. So Long's appeal to us is that we get in the way of evil and suffering when and where we can. And, you know, it's easy now in the political season that we're in to think of, if it's just the right Supreme Court or it's the right, all this evil can be dealt with. And basically Jesus is telling, no, that will never, and we know that, that will never be the fix. So question three here is, I think, the challenge and the invitation for the church is to have this eschatological leaning forward with expectation, something to look forward to. And the reality is that our theology shapes our theodicy shapes our theology, and it also, our eschatology is just immersed in this and how we live this out, and even how we think about theodicy. You look at a lot of the theologies out there have been corrupted by maybe eschatology that is anything but looks like Jesus in its interpretation. So the invitation for us is to step into that. And reality is, with enlightenment, has just impacted so much of how we see and understand all of this. So in closing, I leave you with this image. And it's an image that I've come to appreciate. And you could ask the question, do I understand all that the artists had implied when they drew this? You have an image of Satan here with all of its tentacles. and you see still holding on to the robe of the person that included a person, you see a person between running toward an image of Christ. Do I understand all that? Do I understand all the tensions? Am I courageous enough to answer one of the 75 questions that God asked of Job? No, I'm not about to answer any of those questions. Do I understand the mystery between evil and suffering and the omnipotence and the omniscience of God? Do I understand all that? No, I don't. But this I do know. I know how the story ends. I know how the story ends. And he's risen, and I serve a risen Savior. And it's to that ending, or to that conclusion of being glorified with Christ, that I can lean into with my theodicy and my eschatology and my theology, and look forward to in faith and also in confidence. Thank you. Thank you.